Hello and welcome back to another episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. I'm your host, Misha, and for today's podcast, I had the honour of interviewing a very distinguished guest. Benjamin Zephaniah is best known as one of Britain's favourite poets. He's also a political activist, playwright and novelist who has been listed as one of Britain's 50 greatest post-war writers by the Times newspaper. But one of the lesser-known aspects of Benjamin's life is his interest in foreign languages, and in particular, Mandarin. In his autobiography, The Life and Rhymes of Benjamin Zephaniah, he writes about his decades-long exploration of the Chinese language and culture. I wanted to find out more about why he took on the challenge of learning Chinese, how he went about doing so, and why he believes language learning can be a powerful tool against bigotry and war. Okay, so Benjamin, welcome to the podcast.
It is my pleasure, and I'm so pleased that I'm awake to do it.
The first thing I wanted to ask you was, I remember the first time I interviewed you, which was about 7 years ago. I remember I walked into your office at Brunel University, where you work, and there was a big poster on the wall. It was the first thing I saw, and I think it was like an old ancient Chinese philosopher or something like that. Could you tell us a bit more about what that poster is?
It's a man called Bamuo. Well, the Chinese call him Bamuo, and Indians call him Bodhidharma, and the Japanese have another name for him. I always say to people, try not to have heroes or people that you look up to with too much sense of worship. But he genuinely is, for me, a kind of spiritual hero, if you like. I should start by saying he's the founder of Zen Buddhism, and he was a Buddhist living in India, very wealthy. He was a prince, basically. And it's a similar story to other things you've heard, where he hadn't seen poverty, and then when he saw it, he wanted to go and investigate it. So when he looked out and saw the streets and saw poverty, which he never saw inside the palace, he said, I've got to go and experience the world. And he went on this journey. And he was a Buddhist at a time when Buddhists were singing and chanting, playing drums. And it's difficult to go into all the details, as if I know all the details. I don't know all the details. But he went meditating for years in this mountain, years in that mountain, and ended up in China. By the time he'd reached China, he'd come up with the idea of quiet Buddhism. So Zen Buddhism in Japanese just means quiet Buddhism. Or in Chinese, Chan Buddhism, just means silent Buddhism, which is quite revolutionary at the time, because like I said, everybody was playing drums and ringing bells and doing all kinds of things. He said, no, just sit with yourself and get to know yourself. And so there's lots of stories about him going to the emperor in Guangzhou in China, and the emperor saying to him, you know, do you have a philosophy? And he said, yes, I've got a philosophy. And the emperor said, what is it? He said, no philosophy. You know, that's where we get this idea of Zen from, you know, Zen. When people have Zen phrases, they kind of, sometimes they, on the surface, they seem like they don't make sense, but actually they're quite deep. And then he goes on this long journey and he ends up in a place called the Shaolin Temple in Henan in China. And the temple was actually built for another Indian monk 8 years before that. But Bodhidharma Bamuo ended up there. They wouldn't let him in at first, so he went away and meditated. And then, sometime later, they allowed him in. And he said he had a great respect for the books at the time, but he said, look, enlightenment is not in the books, it's about listening to yourself. And he wanted to teach them a kind of yogic meditation. And they weren't kind of having it. So the Chinese were finding it very difficult to be still and do poses. So he said, okay, I'm going to give you moving yoga. He invented what was then a kind of early form of Tai Chi. It wasn't called Tai Chi. But then when the emperor said, kill them all, he speeded it up and invented Kung Fu. So that's why I love him, because he has this Zen Buddhism about him. When people wanted to follow him, he said, don't follow me, you'll start another religion. There's too many religions. Imagine him then saying too many religions. Look at the world now, you know. And the other thing is, like I said, he started Kung Fu. So for me, he's a bit of a hero that wouldn't want to be a hero.
Mm. I wanted to ask you that because I believe that your interest in the Chinese language was preceded by an interest in meditation and Kung Fu. Can you tell me a bit more about how that interest originated?
I'm very old now, right? I'm almost 100. When I was a kid, Bruce Lee was the superstar. I mean, so if you weren't around then, it's hard to imagine kind of what it was like. Remember, there was only a couple of TV stations. When films came out, they were big. So when you were in the public domain, you really was in the public domain. And Bruce Lee was massive. And I started doing Kung Fu just to emulate Bruce Lee and beat up my friends. Because we'd have all these sparring fights, you know. And And I started doing karate and various types of kung fu. And then I realized that it's not just about the kung fu. There's this thing about conquering the self. And there's this, I hesitate to say it because it's not religious, but there's this kind of spiritual aspect to it, of really getting to, it's a bit like yoga. The Sanskrit word for yoga is union with self or union with God. Because in the Sanskrit tradition, God is within yourself. And it's a bit like that with Kung Fu. It's very similar, you know. You learn to conquer yourself. It's not just about conquering the person in front of you. And I went, wow, this is amazing. And there's some things that are difficult to translate. So the word Kung Fu, for example, a lot of people think Kung Fu, that's fighting. Well, no, you can do a podcast with Kung Fu. You can write an essay with Kung Fu. Kung Fu means hard work. The translation from Chinese means the application of your mind. So when I learned that, I went, wow, that's amazing, because we think of Kung Fu as fighting. So as I started to learn more about the martial arts, I learned more about the kind of spiritual side of it and how much it is about improving yourself. And that's what fascinated me with it. And that happened a very long time ago when I was a kid. And so I've always had an interest in China.
And that interest was then consolidated maybe in the year 2000. I was just reading your autobiography and it's mentioned that in the year 2000, you went on a trip with the British Council, which wasn't particularly inspiring, but it did inspire you to then go back and start doing trips of your own.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was a horrible trip. I mean, I was just working in Hong Kong and I got on a coach trip and did a venture into China with a group of tourists that I would never normally do. But yeah, then I was inspired to go back. I had lots of Chinese friends in England who were studying here. And of course, you realise, you know, that stereotype. I mean, I was guilty of it, that I kind of thought, oh, all Chinese people know Kung Fu. You know what I mean? And I realised that, you know, they didn't. And when I was talking to my Chinese friends and they saw me doing Kung Fu, they'd be so impressed with me. And I go, you know, that is your art. But I do remember once when I was in Shanghai performing my Tai Chi. And I do an authentic form of what they call Chen Tai Chi from a small village in China called Chenjiago. And I was doing it in Shanghai. And there was these two elderly Chinese people who kind of burst into tears. They got really emotional. And they said, you know, a lot of us think that this Chinese culture is old-fashioned and we're all about modernity and everything. To see a foreigner just doing it with such concentration and, you know, when I do my Tai Chi, I do go into a trance. And it really moved them to see a foreigner doing it. So I then kind of started my love affair with going to China in person.
And that was primarily for the Kung Fu at first, but then you started travelling around villages and you describe in the autobiography about travelling around on a bicycle, communicating with locals who spoke no English. And I guess that was the point at which you felt you needed to start to learn some Chinese, because in the villages, unlike in the big cities, people didn't speak English.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, at first, actually, I didn't even feel a need to learn Chinese because all my friends, my Chinese friends in the cities wanted to learn English, and it was more important for them because they wanted to better themselves. And I found this teacher in Chenjiago, the village where I learned my Tai Chi. And when people introduced me to him, they said, he's such a funny guy. He would be teaching me. And sometimes people would hear it and they would start laughing. And I would think, you know, why is he so funny? What's he saying, you know? And he was so affectionate. And I thought, I've got to learn how to communicate with him. And then I went into the villages and I'm a writer. I write poetry and I write novels. And I just knew that these people had really interesting stories. When I was talking to people and somebody was translating for me, I thought, these stories are amazing. So that's when I decided that I had to learn Chinese. And, you know, I'm not a great speaker. I'm probably a better listener. Or if I have no choice, I speak really well. You know, once I remember being stuck on a plane with a Chinese guy next to me, and he really wanted to talk to me. He didn't know any English at all, and that was the best conversation in Chinese I ever had, because I had no choice. And he wanted to tell me about his children and his family, and he supported Chelsea, you know, Chelsea football team, so he wanted to talk about football. And I remember getting off the plane and thinking, wow, you know what I mean, I've just had like 6 hours conversation with this guy. And and I managed to kind of hack it. And some of it was a struggle. But like I said, I'm more of a listener. But I understood that if I really wanted to get to the core of these people in the villages, then I had to learn some Chinese. And I had another experience, because I spent a time in a place called Henan in central China. This is where Shaolin Temple is and Chenjia Go. It's very famous for Kung Fu. But some people call it the Liverpool of China because it's very poor. And then when there's some crime, people go, oh, it's those people from Henan. You know, they always blame people from Henan. They have a bad rap. And they're actually really nice, loving people when you get to know them. But I had one experience where I was riding my bicycle, because I used to, when I wasn't training, take my bicycle and go from village to village and just meet people, you know. And I went to one village and I got lost and I wanted to find a way back. And at this time, I didn't speak any Chinese. So I had a phone. I called a friend in Beijing and said, you know, can you ask this person for directions? I gave my phone to the lady in the village. Well, it was a group of ladies. And they spoke for about half an hour. And then they gave me the phone back. And I said to my friend, what did they say? And she said, I didn't understand the word they said. She just didn't understand them. I said, are they speaking Chinese Mandarin? She said, yeah, but I didn't understand them. She said the accent was just so rough, she didn't understand them. And in Henan, they have that accent, you know, it's like a very strong Liverpudlian accent. I mean, that's probably not a great analogy. And then I realized that actually, even within Mandarin, there's a great diversity in the way people speak. So you go to some parts towards the south, I'm not talking about the Cantonese speaking part, where they will say idian, idia, but in Beijing, they say idiar. You know, they really roll the R's.
I'm wondering, what was it that initially attracted you to the Chinese language? For some people, it's the characters. For some people, it's more the fact that it's a tonal language. What were your initial impressions of Chinese at that time? And what did you find particularly appealing about it?
Well, shame on me, but I've never really studied writing. Recently, some people have shown me some characters, how to do some characters, but it's not been a priority of mine. I have been focused on speaking. But actually, in English, I'm better speaking than writing, I think. And, you know, my poetry is spoken poetry. It's much better when it's heard rather than written. And I also speak Urdu, and I can't write it. I can speak it, though, especially when I'm in Pakistan or India. For me, I must admit, this may sound a bit presumptuous or pretentious, but I was living a good life, right? I mean, this is before I was really an academic. I was doing my poetry shows, my music shows, earning quite a good living. I was young, free and single. I used to just work, and then every summer I would just travel to China. Every winter I'd go somewhere warm, you know, and I didn't really have much responsibility. And if I wanted something, my manager or my agent would get it for me, anything. If I said to my agent, you know, I feel like working in Asia this year, they'd organize tours in Asia. So I had it really good. And so along with all those things that I just mentioned about my teacher and the villagers in China, I needed a project. I needed to do something that would stretch my mind a bit. So when I listened to the Chinese language and some people said it was difficult, I'd go, right, I want to learn it. But let me be absolute honest, right? I mean, the first words I learned in Chinese was like, have you got a boyfriend? Can you dance? Do you want to go out tonight? And stuff like that, you know. I wanted to learn amongst the people. I do have a set of books, and I love going into shops and supermarkets, even here in Britain, and just trying little things out.
It sounded like the way that you went about learning Chinese was largely through communicating with people in real life situations rather than, was there much like formal structure to go alongside that, or was it almost exclusively those kind of communicative methods?
There was a couple of times where I actually formally got a teacher, and literally just, but somebody who would come to my room and give me an hour's lesson or a couple of hours lessons and then go. But actually it was from a book I was studying. It was a book I found really easy because it had lessons and then it had kind of cartoon conversations that you could practice, and you also had a CD. So I'd get a teacher, but I'd say, would you teach me from this book? The strange thing with almost every teacher I had, we became friends, you know, because I was interested in politics and life and everything else, and people within China, you know, they tend to be interested in those things. So yes, it was, but on the whole, it was informal, very, very informal. You know, I have a friend in China, and I met him in a train station. I was in Shanghai, and I was going to Nanjing, and I was doing that thing that you always do if you don't know the scene very well, looking at the board, looking at the time, trying to work out what was what. And he came up to me and he said, "Can I help you?" And I told him, you know, I was looking for this train, and he helped me out. And then he said to me, "What are you doing in China?" So I said, "Oh, I just come here every year. I just come out, hang out with my friends, and I go and do some martial arts, and I just like visiting different cities." So we talked for 5 or 10 minutes, and then he said, "You know, tell me, what are you really doing here?" So I said, "Man, I just told you." And then after another 10 minutes, he said, "Come on, tell me, what's your job? What do you do?" So I told him what I do, and I said, "I'm just here to hang out." And he said, "You're not working here." I said, "No, I just come for the people and the culture and the language." And he hugged me. And you know, Chinese people don't hug very much. He hugged me, said, "You're one of the very first foreigners I've ever met that's not, you know, here because his company has sent him. You know, not here because he's an entrepreneur trying to make some money out of the Chinese. Not here because he's just got a Chinese girlfriend or something like that." "No, man, I just love the place. I just come out." And we are still good friends to this day. He's got twin girls, and his twins, they've come and stayed with me in England now. I mean, I've watched them grow up. It's difficult to make friends in China as a man, to make male friends. I can make friends, or you can make friends, as you know, in England, because you support the same football team or something like that, you know? In China, no. If you are a man and you go home to your parents or your wife, and you say, "I've got a friend," they say, "Why? What's the purpose of this?" You kind of almost have to justify it. So it takes time to make friends, but I have found friends through music, martial arts, and just being interested in China rather than interested in getting something out of China. And once you break that barrier, they really appreciate you.
One thing I wanted to ask you was that the way that you describe learning Chinese, largely through, getting stuck into the culture and speaking to people, communicating with people, that aspect of language learning in general is something that a lot of people generally find very daunting. People are terrified of speaking the language when they first learn it because they're afraid of making mistakes and that kind of thing. I'm wondering whether the fact that your background was in poetry performance, whether that helped you then when it came to performing in Chinese, performing in a foreign language.
Possibly, because I like listening, and then I can mimic. The thing with me is, like when I was learning Urdu, there's something that Urdu speakers do with their body. So this is going to be a terrible thing to do on a podcast or on radio. But if you look at me now, the way that an Urdu speaker asks what your name is, don't just listen, but look, they go, "Aap kya naam kya hai?" And there's something about the way they do it and the way they move, which as a performer I really like, you know what I mean? And so with every language, I find the only languages I speak is English, Chinese, a bit of Chinese, and a bit of Urdu, right? So I'm not an expert. But with every language comes a, I was going to say an attitude, but a way that they move their bodies, the way they move their heads. Sometimes when you hear Arabic people speaking, they could be speaking passionately about poetry and love poetry, but it looks like they're arguing. You know, it looks like they're arguing. And so I pick up on that quite well, I think. So there's some things I say in Chinese. One of the things I always say to Chinese people when I meet them is, "我的中文说得不好." And they go, "God, you say that so well." So it's like a contradiction. I'm saying that I don't speak Chinese very well, but you're saying it so well, you know? It's because it's practice and I can put my body into it.
I think one of the distinguishing features about Chinese is the tones, I guess. How did you find that? Because I could hear in the way that you were just saying that you clearly were saying it with the tones. Sometimes when foreigners speak Chinese, they just kind of forget about the tones. You kind of obviously got a knack for mimicking that.
If you're going to say something like, "What is your name?" you can't go, "Ni Zhou Shema Minza." You know, you have to put your, you know, and that's why I like to listen to people and then copy them in a way. The tones can be really difficult, and I still get them confused a bit. The two that I remember, though, I struggle with the middle two, but the first two, the first one and the last one, I'm quite good at, because, again, with performing, I remember a teacher once said to me, "The first one, hold it like you're holding a note, like you're singing." Most people default to ma, you know, chi, chi. And the second one, say it like you're angry. Stamp your foot when you first say it if you want. Ma! If you say to stamp your foot, you say it like, ma! You know? And then the other two are a little bit more difficult. You've got to go up and down. And but yeah, people do find them difficult. But I would say don't be scared of them. And the other thing is, you know, when you go to a country and you try to learn a language, I found this in most countries, nobody tells you off. They say, oh, good, keep trying, you know. Nobody says, that's terrible, you know, go home. They encourage you on the whole. Sometimes they're too encouraging, you know. I'll say to them, criticize me, tell me what I'm doing wrong. But, you know, okay, we don't have kind of tones in our structure of the language like Chinese does. But we do in the way we say things. So, for example, there's a story, a friend of mine wrote a poem about something she saw. She was in a shop and a child was playing up and the mother wanted the child to come along, you know, we've got to get out and go home. And the child said, but mommy, I want sweeties. And mommy said, I'll give you sweeties. Now, you know, the mother is saying, I'll give you sweeties, but she doesn't mean that. We know because of the tone. And we know that if I say, I love you, there's a lots of ways I can say it and it will have a different meaning. You know, I love you is different from I love you. Yeah, I mean, so if you can understand that, that's very much more complex in a sense, because that's not written in the grammar. That's us reading body language and hearing emotion. So if you think about going to Chinese and seeing tones that are structured in the grammar, actually, you shouldn't fear it. I do find it difficult sometimes, but I go, you know, you just have to do it. And I've got friends in Beijing who are African guys who haven't formally studied Chinese, but they speak fluent Chinese because they've lived there for so long. And I say to them, did you go to classes? They go, no, I just hang out with people. I just pick it up all the time. And when I say to them, did you study the tones? They go, no. And they're doing the tone perfectly. But they learned it like a child, you see. They learned it in real time.
I wanted to ask you, in recent years, the political situation between China and the West has obviously soured quite a bit. Do you think that learning a new language like Chinese and learning a new culture can help to bridge that divide?
I've always said that if I was the Minister of Education in Britain, the first thing I would do is make it mandatory for children to go and experience another culture. And I wouldn't send them to France or Germany or, you know, Holland. They would have to go to Asia or Africa and try and understand how other people live and how other people see the world. Now, why do I do that? Because I think you're less likely to go to war with people you understand. I'd rather invest in understanding than investing in war. You know, so that may sound like a very expensive project, but compare it to how expensive the project of war is. I mean, war is much more expensive. So invest in peace. You know, it's not a perfect solution, and I don't think it would stop all wars, but we would have a better understanding of the Chinese. The Chinese see the world from a particular point of view that has its good and bad points, but so do we. We see the world from a particular point, the West do. And the West has a lot of arrogance. And so it doesn't mean the West is all bad. The Chinese have arrogance in some areas too. So to me, it's really important to understand the culture. There's a book I would recommend called Dreaming in Chinese. It's about the Chinese language. There's no learning of the language in it, or very little. It's about understanding the culture and understanding why they do the things that they do. So why is it that Chinese, for example, if you have a Chinese friend and you keep saying please or sorry, they feel it's slightly offensive. You know, and the English are always going, I'm sorry, you know. And when I found I was in China, I used to go, Dui bichi. And they'd look at me, and especially people who I was close to. And then I realised that if you're really good friends, they think that you don't really need to keep saying please or keep saying sorry, because we should understand each other, you know. And it's little things like that, and about their table manners, why they make so much noise when at the table, they burp and fart and all kinds of things, you know what I mean? It's a kind of appreciation of food. Where we think, be quiet, you shouldn't even make a sound, then you chew, you know. So it's a great book for that. Like I said, it's about the culture that comes with the language and why they use words the way they do. You know, when Chinese people are learning English, they find it so difficult to distinguish when they're talking about somebody, to say him or her. Because as you know, in Chinese, they don't have that. And, you know, you can get a Chinese professor who's kind of done a lot in English and they still get confused by that.
It's called Dreaming in Chinese, Lessons in Love, Life and Mandarin by Deborah Fallows.
That's it.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because recently I've been watching a lot of Chinese dramas on Netflix and Chinese films on Netflix. And the one thing that you always notice is that whenever there's a scene where they're eating, they make a they'll make really loud noise, slurping all the noodles and that kind of thing, which is like obviously considered quite rude in British culture, but not in there. So there's that contrast. I wanted to ask you whether you see yourself continuing to learn Chinese and perhaps when restrictions allow you to do so, to go back to China and continue exploring that culture?
Most of my family live in England, so I've been seeing them. I have some family in Jamaica and I've had some contact with them. But I have to say, one of the people I really miss is my Tai Chi teacher in China. I see him every year, or up until recently. I used to go and see him every year and I just miss him so much. And there's other friends who I regularly see and I miss them and I just miss my trips. The mood has changed. I've got friends in China who told me that the mood has changed for foreigners now. There's a bit more suspicion and that's very sad. But we are people, we are artists, we are creative. We, I hope, are intelligent, if not intellectuals. We got to cut through that political BS and connect with people as human beings. And that's what I try to do with music and poetry. And that's what I try to do with people. And that's what I try to do with martial arts even. I have some great martial arts friends who they may speak a bit of English. I may speak a bit of Chinese, but we really love communicating with each other through the art that we love. And we kind of ignore the politics at the end of it. I mean, you alluded to my trips to Russia back in the day and across the Iron Curtain and Cuba and North Korea. I've been to all these places. And one of the things that I found is that when you go into people's homes, living rooms and kitchens, you're so much the same. You're so much the same. You may have a slightly different way of cooking the potato, but when it comes to the main things that we want in life, peace, schools, freedom, to walk the streets, all those things, there's very little difference.
Well, that's a very inspiring message to end on. So once again, thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. I'm sure our listeners will have found that very interesting to hear all about your experiences. So thank you very much.
Zaijian.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.